Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll explore a number of subjects in the news, and we'll be exploring Senator Gary Hart's new book, The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. Gary Hart is a former candidate for the President of the United States. He represented Colorado in the United States Senate from 75 to 87. He was the co-chair of the U.S. Commission on National Security in the 21st Century, which warned of the massive homeland terror attack as early as the fall of 1991. And he spent 8 months of 2001 trying to persuade government leaders of the possibility of an attack on the homeland. He actually addressed the FAA, International Air Traffic Controllers, about a week or so before 9/11, telling them that aircraft could be used. And then he spent the week before 9/11 talking to Condoleezza Rice in the White House, trying to warn her. So he's a very prescient man, and his new book, The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons, he'll be followed by Rabbi Michael Lerner, who has a new book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. And this has already become a bestseller, this book of Rabbi Lerner's, and we'll be talking to him. Let's now go to Senator Gary Hart. I'm speaking with Gary Hart, the author of The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. Gary Hart's represented Colorado in the United States Senate from 1975 to 1987. He's the author of 15 books. He's taught at Yale, lectured at the University of California and Oxford University, and has earned a Doctor of Philosophy in Politics in 2001. As the co-chair of the United States Commission on National Security in the 21st century, he was credited with forecasting a 9/11 type attack. And your new book deals with strategy and a strategic vision, which has always seems to be lacking, I'm afraid. And here we have our latest adventure or misadventure in the Middle East, which apparently lacked any strategic vision, collapsing around our ears. Is much of what we're going to be talking about in the next year or so who lost the Middle East?
Quite possibly. It may be determined by events of the next few days or a couple of weeks. If civil war breaks out in Iraq, and let me qualify that I'm not a Middle East expert, but most people who are believe it will quickly spread beyond its borders, in which case the challenge will be to get America's army out of there before it's destroyed. I don't mean to be apocalyptic, but I was thinking today of Napoleon in Moscow in 1812. The people of Moscow retreated. Napoleon occupied their capital. They burned it down around him, and he lost his army getting out of Russia. And I think it's not too great of a dramatization to say something like that, 1 in 10 chances something like that could happen to the United States Army.
But this is not to say that the United States is weak. This is an indictment of the impetuous and immature use of American power.
Precisely.
Which has undermined our strength. So this is what I'm afraid of, is that the jihadis already believe, they're delusional, but they believe that they were the reason that brought down the evil empire, the Soviet Union, from Afghanistan. And if they drive us out of Iraq, which is, I think, quite likely, then they'll be drunk with power. They'll feel that they've defeated two superpowers.
Well, I think one of the regional strategic fears is that Shiites in Iran will make common cause, obviously, with their colleagues across the border. And then you have the possibility for a major shift of power and influence in the region, influencing the Saudis, influencing oil supplies, and all the other things that we hold dear about that region.
Well, I think it's already happened, hasn't it, that our strategic blunder in Iraq has rewarded Iran, you know, I mean...
Well, they've managed to strengthen their hand two ways. One, the rise of the Shiite influence, the majority Shiite influence in Iraq, and two, their, at least for the time being, they're thumbing their nose at us and the Western democracies on the issue of nuclear energy.
So there's also the possibility that Ahmadinejad's hand is behind this unrest. It's his way of reminding us who's got the levers of power in that part of the world.
Oh, I think no question about that.
And I want to get to the substance of your book and of much of what you're offering up here in terms of a new strategic landscape and how to deal with it. But just the moment we're at seems to be such a powerful one in terms of a portent of a terrible American defeat. Do you think that the president can get out of this? Because I believe that their strategy will be to say, well, we did the best we could, we tried, it failed, not our fault, it's their fault, they don't want democracy. And the American people, I think, are so anxious about this mistake, they'd like to get out of it. You think it'll be forgive and forget?
I have no idea. I think you can't have 25,000 casualties, which is what we've suffered, and to a degree our British allies as well, without some recrimination. Somebody sometime is going to start asking questions, how did this all happen? Now, it hasn't happened now for very peculiar political reasons, and that is both houses of the Congress belong to the president's party. And to my knowledge, there's not been 1 minute of hearings in either house on the conduct of the war for 3 years. And all you have to do is think back to the 60s and early 70s, where a Democratic Congress held hearings on Vietnam while a Democrat, at least in Lyndon Johnson's time, was in office and helped bring about the end of that war. But the Republicans in Congress are not doing that. I think, frankly, as we did not learn from the French experience in Indochina, we did not learn from the British experience in the Middle East and particularly in Iraq.
Well, it remains to be seen, I guess, whether there'll be accountability. But I think we'll maybe a good part of a trillion in the hole, as together with the 25,000 lives and perhaps 100,000 Iraqi lives.
Yes.
Let's turn to your book, The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. And, of course, you had a prominent role as a co-chair of the United States Commission on National Security in the 21st Century, and where you warned of massive homeland security terror attacks early. This took place in the fall of 1999, and you spent the 8 months of 2001 trying to persuade government leaders that the threat was urgent and action was needed. And I believe you spoke to Condoleezza Rice the day before, or was it 2 days
before?
What
happened was I had known her. She got her graduate degrees from the University of Denver, and when I was a candidate for national office in 84, she helped advise me on U.S.-Soviet relations, which was her specialty as a graduate student. So I'd known her off and on over the years and kept in touch with her when she was at Stanford. And so I met her, I saw her after she was named National Security Advisor in the spring of 2001, and she said, come around and I'd love to talk to you. I didn't have an opportunity until that fall, and I gave a speech, ironically, to the International Air Transportation Association in Montreal. And the headlines in the Montreal papers the next morning were, Hart predicts terrorist attacks on America. And I flew directly down to Washington, went to her office, and I said, please, please get going on Homeland Security. And that was September the 6th, 5 days before the attack.
And why is it then that do you think that we got off, I mean, do you think that we got off on the wrong foot in the sense that after 9/11, after all, the United Nations is headquartered in New York, the funeral pyres of 3,000 souls are still in the air, and our first impulse, at least our government's first impulse, was unilateralism, as opposed to the multilateral opportunity that was presented with all of the world's sympathy. The fact that the UN is headquartered in New York, almost a company town, and more importantly, the problem of terrorism is over there, not here. So it seems like a no-brainer that you've got to engage others.
There were ideological imperatives behind all this. Richard Clark documented this in his book on the early Bush years, and others have supported that since then, including the chief of staff to former Secretary of State Colin Powell. And they both said that the principles in the Bush administration came into office with Saddam Hussein in their gun sights. And every time, Richard Clark said, every time he would encounter Paul Wolfowitz or anyone else in the halls of the or corridors of the White House, and he would say Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, the response he got was Saddam Hussein and Iraq. Now, this all started with the so-called Project for a New American Century in the 1990s. The signers of a letter to Bill Clinton in 1998 urging the overthrow of Saddam Hussein were almost all of the same people, so-called neoconservatives, who concocted the war against Saddam. And I gather from news reports in the last few days, there are memos where Donald Rumsfeld is quoted as saying, on the afternoon of September the 11th, link this to Saddam, whatever it takes. That is scandalous, historically scandalous.
Well, I believe the first meeting that took place after the president settled down and went to Camp David, that both Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld did proffer this idea of attacking Iraq.
Well, they've been proffering it for years before that. So all they did was use the excuse of the attacks to carry out an agenda in the Middle East. I mean, I think the long-term objective was imperial. That is to say, we'll depose Saddam, we'll impose a Chalabi-friendly government, and they will then invite us to base ourselves politically and militarily in their country, and we can then dominate the region.
But even President Bush's own father counseled against it. All of his people understood at the end of the first Gulf War that once you break it, you own it, to quote Colin Powell. And surely that counsel was offered. Was it heard?
I mean, clearly not, or things would have been different. Yeah. I think what happened was in the so-called neoconservatives it felt that Bush, the father, and his ilk were so-called foreign policy realists. That is to say, they managed the world according to kind of the realities of the day, whereas they held themselves, the neoconservatives held themselves out to be visionaries, and in heavily ideological sense, that it was their mission to remake the world. And it was that's vastly different from what the father believed.
How do you explain, though, this capture of U.S. foreign policy? If you had this tradition that, I guess, it goes through the Kissingerian period, which is to manage things, that there's no absolute good or evil, versions of realpolitik where you act in your interests, not necessarily according to your ideals. These people have been around forever. How did they get capture the foreign policy? Because it seems to me the chief enablers of this have to be Rumsfeld and Cheney, because I don't, these people haven't written that much. They're just good on television at filibustering people. In fact, that's why Brent Scowcroft didn't step up to the plate. He just didn't want to be shouted at on television because he's a gentleman.
Well, he wrote a contrarian op-ed piece in the New York Times, and they just took his head off as being out of date. Right. I think it goes back to the Cold War, second half of the Cold War. The people that have tried to answer that question there was an intellectual underpinning, and it was involved Robert Kagan and William Kristol and a variety of number of people who strongly disagreed, particularly with Ronald Reagan's second term embrace of Gorbachev. Right. They hated the Soviet Union. It turns out they also hated Russia, which is an even broader proposition. And they felt dealing with them rather than crushing them was morally wrong. Right. And that when the Cold War ended, then they were in search for a decade of a new cause. Right. And when George Bush came into office, they didn't have that cause until 9/11. And they overthrew the Taliban and then went about what they really were up to, which was dominating the Middle East.
But they got the Cold War wrong. The Team B got everything wrong, which was the genesis of the same group of people.
Of course.
The whole idea of the war on terror, the earlier war on terror, the Soviet behind terror, turned out that they were actually quoting CIA black propaganda.
Yes.
And eventually, they had to tell Bill Casey that that this is our own stuff. They've got this thing wrong as well.
Well, this is an important point.
Is this the end of them?
This is an important point, because when you say Team B, I'm sure your listeners know what that means. Right. Under Bush 1, they were trying to get the CIA to say certain things that the CIA didn't believe. Right. And so there has always been this tension between the genuine, honest intelligence community and the ideologues who want them to deliver opinions that they don't believe in. And that's why I think they put a medal around George Tenet's neck, because he finally caved in.
Well, you deal with intelligence in your new book, The Shield and the Cloak. It's a part of a number of things that you're suggesting. Have we reformed intelligence? I mean, is the DNI I mean, it seems to me just another political layer.
It is. It is. And I think if you go back in the history of how the CIA was created in the National Security Act of 1947, it was created in with the opposition of the Defense Department. The Defense Department did not want an independent intelligence agency. And so between 1947 and 2001, there was this constant tension and struggle between DOD, Defense Department, and CIA, and when Donald Rumsfeld came in, he simply bypassed it. When the CIA wouldn't give him what he wanted, he created his own intelligence operation in the Pentagon that was ideologically stacked to turn out the opinions that he wanted.
Well, they may well have turned out the Niger forgeries, too. I mean, it's extraordinary that the Office of Special Plans is now in investigation. But,
yes.
You know, the other shoe hasn't dropped as to whether they went as far as to create their own intelligence in the absence of anything real. But it is scandalous. And in the context of this vast effort in the Middle East, turning not just into being counterproductive, but maybe the ultimate scenarios that you talk about in your book, where we'll have an oil shutdown. I mean, it's not preposterous, and it's not unlikely.
No.
So let's run through some of the suggestions you've got in terms. I mean, the opening statement I made is we desperately need strategic vision. I mean,
yes.
You know, without strategic vision, whatever you do tactically, it's whistling past the graveyard. It was that way in Vietnam, and it's that way in Iraq.
Yes. Well, the book posits two premises that are new and different, I think. I don't know anyone else that is making these arguments. First is that security in the 21st century is going to look like and sound like much differently from the 20th. The 20th century's national security meant prevention of an exchange of nuclear missiles between us and the Soviet Union. My argument is in the 21st century, security is inevitably going to include security of livelihood, the ability of a family to provide for itself, security of the community, security of energy, and security of the environment. If any of those things goes wrong, we can have secure borders and people are not going to feel secure. And the second argument is there is the notion of national security. Increasingly in the globalized world, we cannot be secure if the rest of the world is insecure, at least our democratic allies. So the idea of going in alone, as we did in Iraq, is pure folly if you really do care about making America secure. We need our allies' help. And so those are the two basic arguments. And then I have specifics about creation of an international peacemaking force, declaring Persian Gulf a zone of international interest and turning it over to the UN to guarantee oil supplies, creation of a human intelligence corps within the CIA, and a group of ideas like that.
And just in terms of politics, don't you think that these ideas need a new kind of polity, that we have these kind of stale, rigid, Democratic-Republican positions now? The Democrats have always been on the defensive on national security, and curiously enough, it's this ports issue that's brought them back up, and that's a bogus issue, but I'm happy to see somebody beating up the president with something. But the long and the short of it is, you can form your coalitions. For example, the environmentalists on the left and the national security hawks on the right recognize, I think, that going green is a national security imperative.
Yes.
So do you see any hope here of creating new political coalitions?
Well, the purpose of the book, frankly, is to give my party some ideas, if not intellectual content, for the formulation of a new security policy. Simply voting against the president, which the Democrats haven't been doing very much of, or saying we should cut the defense budget isn't a policy. And I think it's part of the reason since Vietnam that we have lost the confidence of the American people. So I think there are a set of principles and concrete proposals that the Democrats can stand on. And if they don't like mine, then they should come up with some of their own. But until we convince the majority of people in this country that we can make America at least as secure as the president and the Republicans, I think we're always going to be in the minority.
And do you think that there will be, there's been talk about a contract with America type of democratic manifesto? It's been in the works for a while there. I mean, I can see that you're stepping up to the plate here, because I don't see a lot of of intellectual hardware out there.
I think that's absolutely true. And I've sat in on a session 3 or 4 months ago in Washington where 60 people were around the table representing almost that many ancillary affiliate organizations of the Democratic Party, and it was a cacophony of ideas and proposals, none of which gelled into anything concrete.
And what about in terms of you got the new Human Intelligence Corps and a special forces, which I guess is separate from or apart from the four services that have their own special forces.
Yes.
What's the idea there?
Well, the idea is that each of the traditional services has its own special branch or special force,
right,
and they do cooperate. But I think if the warfare of the future is as it was in Mogadishu and Fallujah, you are going to need a fifth service, which consolidates the Rangers, the Delta Force, the SEALs, and those other special intervention forces so that they are trained and equipped to operate together.
And what about the cultural deficit? For example, let's take Fallujah. I mean, we don't have many people that speak Arabic, and certainly not, they don't know the town. A lot of it was, you know, probably could have been negotiated away. The Marines weren't happy going in there. They had to go into because a bunch of contractors got killed. That leads into the broader question about what are the soft levers that you can use? For example, do you get more bang for the buck with Peace Corps, AID, NGOs, humanitarian aid? I mean, have we done an accounting on whether the what we spend militarily could be achieved, not, you know, in part by other measures?
What Joe Nye calls soft power. Absolutely. Yeah. I think there's no question about it. And I make my own argument on that. Actually, I had a previous book about a year and a half ago called The Fourth Power, which is America's principles. Together with our economic, political, and military power, we have a fourth power, which are our constitutional systems and principles that we abandoned and neglected our peril and to our detriment.
Well, but, we've disgraced at Abu Ghraib and Gitmo.
Absolutely.
Has had terrible consequences.
Yes.
The decent respect for the opinions of mankind?
Jefferson. No, but the gap, hypocrisy is defined as the gap between what you claim and what you do. Right. And in this case, we're a very hypocritical nation, no question about it. But in principle, yes, you're absolutely right. We're not an administration, a government committed to use of military force to solve the world's problems is shortchanging the human side of the equation.
So what, just in terms of the current disaster that we're seeing unfold here in Iraq and the possibility of a massive-scale April 1975 Saigon retreat under fire and a national humiliation, again, not necessarily one that reflects the power of the United States, but the abuse of power in the sense that this was not properly thought out and not properly executed. Nevertheless, we do have, and most of your ideas here are about reorienting the military, but we have this bizarre situation where not only is money going out the door in supplementals to the Halliburtons of this world without any oversight, we still have the old Cold War weapon system.
Yes.
So it's not as if it's an either-or situation where the Pentagon has had to say, look, we've got a new threat out here. We're going to have to be lean and mean and smart and no more, you know, let's get the Timex version, not the Rolex version of the weapon system. We don't need all this, these F-22s and all this stuff.
Right.
But the bizarre thing that's going on now is that they're funding both.
I know.
And we're going broke.
I know. This is because there is an administration that is not exercising any restraint on military spending. So it's everything for everybody. It's pretty much the same with our domestic surveillance, for example. Alberto Gonzalez gets anything he wants. The Patriot Act was roughly the domestic equivalent of what you're talking about. That is to say, give the security people anything they want, and if they abuse it, that's too bad. No, but you're absolutely right. The great ship of defense is sailing down the ocean, still on the course that it was in the Cold War years, but we're also now realizing Donald Rumsfeld's beginning to go lighter and quicker and faster, but he doesn't have a clue as to what the nature of the warfare of the future is. And it really is Mogadishu and Fallujah. It's low-intensity urban conflict between and among tribes, clans, and gangs increasingly, and that's not the warfare we're preparing for.
But you point out here that there's diplomacy, finance, and the military. Those are the three prongs.
Economics, politics, and
yeah,
and
in
the
other
military.
Words, you try and persuade, you bribe, or you beat them over the head. And it
those
seems
were my terms, but somebody else said.
Yeah, yeah. But the long and the short of it is, in a position then, with what's happening to us now, to maintain the kind of people in the military? I mean, the best and brightest have been sent into harm's way without proper body armor, without a mission, without an exit strategy, and based on a bunch of lies, to be blunt. At least the administration has never had a straight story about why we went in. They've changed their mind periodically. So what about our capital in terms of the boys and girls in uniform? Do you think they're still going to step up to the plate?
Well, yes, I do. But even more to the litany that you mentioned, I would add repeated deployments or continued deployments, not only of the regular forces who sign on for that, right, but the reserve force. 40% of our forces there are National Guard and Reserves, and they've been re-upped, as they say. They've been right. their tours have been extended over and over and over again. What it does is deplete the forces, both regular and reserve, and the equipment that they use. It took us 15 to 20 years to recover after Vietnam to rebuild our forces. It will take us at least the same length of time after Iraq.
So you're not worried then that this is going to make the military, like, you know, after Vietnam, the military were orphans. Nobody wanted to join. It is a volunteer military. So does that in any way suggest a need for a draft?
No, unless cataclysm broke out, obviously, right, and hordes were pouring across our borders. But what it does mean is we're going to have to reward the people who do opt for military service better than we are. And I don't mean just monetarily, but in terms of taking care of their families. Mm-hmm. The livelihood of the families of some of these lower-ranking soldiers is pretty grim. And then you've got the problem of taking care of the veterans when they come home. And one of the ironies of American politics is those who are most eager to go to war are those who often do not vote for the resources necessary to support the veterans when they come back.
Well, I just saw on television a grandfather going off to war. I mean, you get the feeling that they're pushing the limits of the Guard.
There's no question.
But on the notion because many people on the left have a knee-jerk reaction to the draft, and you know, they think that this is going to be inevitable, and then, you know, the draft army in the Vietnam War was one of the reasons that we forced us to get out. Isn't there a more holistic way to look at national service? I mean, couldn't you have a draft, for example, that allowed people to go into the Peace Corps, to the Conservation Corps, to the Nursing Corps? I mean, a lot of, you know, in other words, a sense of public service is. I mean, are you satisfied that the volunteer army is the way to go, or do you still have some sense of going back to the founding fathers, the citizens' army?
These are apples and oranges. I have been an advocate for 25 years of national service, but voluntary national service.
Right.
We will not go back to the draft because the people of this country won't support it.
Right.
Not only the young people, but their parents as well. They don't see the need for it. Lyndon Johnson was able to fight the Vietnam War because we had a draft in being at the time. He didn't have to institute a draft. Mm-hmm. And since 75, 30 years, we have not had that draft. If we proposed it today, the streets of Los Angeles and everywhere else would be full of students and young people protesting, and that would be the end of it. But I do believe there ought to be, in the Kennedy-esque sense of the word, the opportunity for young people to give something back to their country, either as civilians or in the military.
But it's odd because people really, the only bright light in Katrina was the National Guardsmen showing up.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't get the disconnect between the kids who'd be furious about the draft at the same time the sense that that you could appeal to this same generation, you know,
It's appealing to them and ordering them.
I see. So you'd take the gentle
approach.
I'd
appeal to them. Well, I think the president, I mean, the National Guard ought to be here. The commission on which I serve said that under our Constitution, what was called the militia in the early days, now the National Guard, is given the constitutional mandate to protect this country at home. And they're all over in Iraq. And disproportionately, they're made up of the so-called first responders, cops, firemen, emergency health workers. So we are doubly vulnerable here in this country. Those first responders are over there, and they're wearing National Guard uniforms, and they should be here being equipped and trained for the terrorist threat.
Well, just, Gary Hart, on the terrorist threat, it does seem that the president often brings up bin Laden, and bin Laden himself makes the odd appearance on Al Jazeera. But just recently, the president said we've got to take bin Laden's threat seriously. It's sort of in contrast at one of the darkest moments in this country's history. FDR said we have nothing to fear but fear itself. So I don't understand how it is that the lone superpower is quaking in its boots. I mean, do you think the extent to which the president has the president inadvertently elevated bin Laden on the world stage as an equal player by continually making him the threat that he says he is? I just fail to see how a cave dweller is equal to the lone superpower.
The answer to your question is yes, the president has, in the service of keeping the Iraq war going. And it's a non sequitur in the sense that we let bin Laden get away and Tora Bora, along with possibly 3,000 to 4,000 Taliban and al-Qaeda supporters, in order to prosecute the war against Saddam, who had nothing to do with the attacks on this country. And the mythology, as you've said, you used the word lies, I would say the mythology over the past 3 or 4 years has been this is somehow connected, and it simply is not. They had a pre-terrorist scheme to overthrow Saddam Hussein, full stop.
But given that the response, they didn't necessarily follow your prescription from the Hart-Rudman Commission, although you were the first to enunciate the need for homeland security, the homeland security is becoming the butt of everybody's joke. You've just seen the hearings.
Right.
I don't think anybody has any confidence. It seems like $80 billion have gone for a color code. They tell you what day an attack is likely, but not what you can do. So they, in effect, they've devalued this this notion. So
no
my
question.
Fear is that our response, and if we are attacked again, which is I imagine will happen eventually, that we will essentially punish ourselves. We'll go into a frenzy. You know, so far, you travel a lot at the airports. It's less convenient, right?
Yes, for sure.
That doesn't mean that somebody couldn't go and place a nuke inside a container. It's just that's where all our focus has been. So what about this idea that we punish ourselves and not the bad guys?
Well, we're punishing ourselves in the wrong way. Port security, leaving aside the Dubai issue, port security is a serious, serious problem. We're inspecting fewer than 5% of the containers coming into this country, and that's a big, big problem. Back to the department, here ideology does play a role. If you don't believe in government, then you're probably not going to be very good at it. And Republicans don't believe in government. So what do? Reluctantly, they created the department, and then they made a hash of it by putting incompetent people in charge. And David Brooks in the New York Times then writes, see, this is proof government doesn't work.
Because
so it's a cyclical argument.
So the Michael Browns, the kind of
exactly
affirmative action for country club Republicans.
or horse trainers or whatever he was.
Well, I thank you very much for your book.
Great pleasure.
The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. And I appreciate the fact that somebody out there is thinking about these big issues, because everybody in the world complains that we live in a one-party state where we have a government that many people are unhappy with, but not a viable opposition. And we've got a few months before 06, as you've pointed out. In 06, I guess there could be a change. If the Democrats win in one of the two chambers, that would give them subpoena power, and instead of having hearings into steroids and sports, we'd actually perhaps learn about what's been happening.
But the Democrats will not win by default. That's the problem. People people don't swing from one party to the other. They swing against one party, and then they become neutral and wait to see what the other party has to offer. And my party hasn't offered much recently.
And even if, as we speak, we're poised to have the biggest foreign policy disaster in modern American history, worse than the loss of China, Korea, North Vietnam, you still don't think that's enough. In other words, the Democrats can't, if these guys are going to self-destruct in Iraq, which they appear to have done, and they may skate, you know, unless the other side comes up with a narrative.
The Democrats could win by default in that circumstance, but their mandate to govern would be very short and very narrow, and they'd have to come up with some positive proposals once in office.
I thank you so much for joining.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Gary Hart, who's a former candidate for the President of the United States. He represented Colorado in the United States Senate from 75 to 87. He was the co-chair of the U.S. Commission on National Security in the 21st Century, which warned of the massive homeland terror attack as early as the fall of 1991. I'm speaking with Rabbi Michael Lerner, the author of The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. Rabbi Lerner, do you think that we're at a moment now where our politics are going to be dominated by the question of who lost Iraq, in the sense that the civil war appears to be breaking out? It's probably going to spill into a regional war. It may involve the cutoff of the supply of oil from the Persian Gulf. And this administration, it's after all their war. They promised us democracy, to get rid of tyrants, to secure oil and to take the pressure off Israel. And it all appears to be blowing up in our face. So do you think that this is what we're going to be talking about in the next year or so? Who lost Iraq or the Middle East?
Well, I think that there's certainly that possibility, and the objective conditions certainly would allow that. But you have to have leadership on the other side. You have to have a Democratic Party, a Green Party, and other anti-war forces articulating a clear alternative, and that's what you don't really hear very much. I think it's a big mistake to narrow the discussion in the way to who lost Iraq, but to instead use this moment to at least couple that discussion with a much broader and more important discussion, which is why we who are spiritual progressives, of course that's the organization that I'm building, a network of spiritual progressives, don't draw the lesson only this particular intervention was a mistake, but want to challenge the whole way of thinking that is shared by both Republicans and many Democrats, that when the United States thinks globally, that it should think in terms of dominating, controlling other people as the way to achieve our own security. I think that that strategy has been fundamentally shown to be mistaken, not just in this particular intervention, but overall in the course of the last 5,000 years, the strategy of domination and control has not yielded a world of peace and real security for people.
But Rabbi Lerner, isn't that partly due to the fact that we're living beyond our means, that we because of our high consumption and standard of living that's predicated upon other people's resources, and furthermore, the war that we're talking about, the one that we're about to lose, is largely being financed by China and Japan, who are lending us the money, and in effect, we're all shopping at the mall while the world is going south.
Well, it's certainly true that that the United States has been incredibly irresponsible financially, and in terms of worrying about the future of the United States as an economic power, the policies of the Bush administration have been incredibly destructive. But again, I don't want to reduce the conversation to a matter of finances. It's a matter of, from my standpoint, it's a matter of moral and spiritual principles. What is the vision of the world that you want to build, and how do you go about building it? And I think that if we were to formulate our talk more in those kinds of terms, we'd be much more likely to be successful in the coming elections.
So, Rabbi Lerner, let's go through a manifesto then of how Because the left throughout the world and in the United States have always been uncomfortable with spiritual matters. The Marxists were boneheaded about it. And it's worth noting the minute that the Soviet Union collapsed, the churches sprung up all over the place. They never really went away. So it's clear that we in this country the two parties are essentially shells. In under the American system, you make your coalitions before the elections, as opposed to the parliamentary system where you make them after the elections. However, in this country, we do not practice coalition building prior to elections. We just wait for some leader on a white horse to take us out of the wilderness, and it never happens.
Yes, so, I think that's certainly a terrible mistake. And one of the things that I even find now when I go around the country, as I have been speaking about the Left Hand of God, my new book, is that people get very excited about the ideas in this book, and I've had tremendous response. And in the it's become in the last 2 weeks since it was just released 2 weeks ago, it's become a national bestseller. And yet, when I meet with people, they're very excited, but then they say to me, "But who in the Democratic Party is the candidate that you're going to support?" And I tried to tell them a story that I got from Hillary Clinton when I was working with her, and she had bought into all the ideas that I was talking about, and so had Bill. But she told me this great story about when FDR was meeting with labor union people, and they were trying to convince him to support the Lehman Act, which was the act to legitimate union organizing in this country in 1934. And after 4 hours of meeting with these union leaders, FDR said to them, "You've totally convinced me. Now go out and force me to do it." And Hillary was saying to me, "Look, Michael, I agree with you, but I'm scared. I don't believe I can do this without there being a movement around me." Now, this is not the Hillary of 2006, where I'm not sure she'd believe with anything that I, agree with any of my ideas anymore. But in 1994, 1992, 1993, 1994, she was agreeing with it, but she was scared because there wasn't a movement. And I think there's a big fantasy in this country that we're going to find the right candidate and that will make everything okay, whereas the only way that the people in politics ever respond is when they see a large surge moving in a particular direction, and then they run out in front and say, "Hey, wait, I'm your leader, I'll be with you." That's how it works. It never works the other way when you're asking for something significant. You're never going to get a... So for those of us who are interested in changing the focus of the liberal and progressive world, as I articulate in this, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right, that there needs to be a new focus. For those of us who want to do that, we have to build a movement from below that is clearly spiritually oriented and that articulates a progressive spiritual vision.
Well, let's elaborate on that. I mean, we're totally in agreement that the two parties are shells. You've got to do your coalition building before the elections. The Republicans have been very skillful, and the Christian conservatives have essentially taken over that shell, that party.
Yes.
Progressives haven't done anything in terms of the Democratic Party, and they're always at war with the centrists. And
yes.
My reading of the American political landscape at this moment, and perhaps it's always been this way, is that there's a huge block of people in the center of this country that are neither Democrat or Republican, and they're ripe for the pickings. And I cannot believe that there's not some kind of manifesto being developed to bring those people into political focus.
Right. Well, now, as you know, in this book that I've written, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right, I studied thousands and thousands and thousands of middle-income working people who were Democratic Party voters who started to move to the right, disassociate themselves from the Democrats, and sometimes vote for the Republicans. And what was striking to me was that this was against their economic interests. And so we studied why they were moving in that direction. And our overall conclusion was that people experienced a spiritual crisis in their lives. Now, of course, when people hear that on the left, they immediately think, "Oh, that's nonsense. Spirituality is baloney. It's just either a code word for sexism, racism, and homophobia, or it's New Age mush. But when we concretely got into what was the spiritual crisis, it turned out that the spiritual crisis in people's lives has two elements. Number one, the hunger for a framework of meaning for their lives. People in the world of work want to contribute to the common good. They want to feel that their work somehow or other, because they spend most of their waking hours in the world of work, they want to feel that their life has some higher meaning or purpose besides just making money for somebody, usually not for themselves, but for the owners of their corporations. So there's a hunger for some kind of framework of meaning or transcendent meaning to life, and the right speaks to that and the left doesn't. And then the second thing is that that there was a hunger for to be seen in non-instrumental terms, for people to be recognized as, what we say in religious terms, embodiments of the sacred, or in Immanuel Kant's secular terms, as subjects and not as objects. In other words, people hate that they're living in a world in which everybody is looking out for number one, and the materialism and selfishness surrounds them and undermines their friendships, their loving commitments, their families that are so often collapsing because each person views himself or herself as a rational maximizer of self-interest. So whenever somebody that comes along, they can find who will satisfy yet more of their needs and become yet a better way to maximize one's self-interest, then one might leave one's family or one's relationships to go on to the next one. This creates tremendous insecurity in people's lives. And this is a spiritual crisis because it's based on the inability of people to see other people as fundamentally sacred or fundamentally deserving of love and caring and respect. And the truth of the matter is that you will never hear this discussed in any public rally of the left, in any political meeting of the left, but in the right, this is a central thing that's being talked about. And so people have responded to the right and moved. Many people have moved to the right, not because they agree with the war in Iraq, because if you'll take the polls, you find out that many Republican voters don't agree with the war in Iraq, or not because they agree with cutting the taxes of the wealthy in order to screwing the poor. That's not true that many of those people who've moved to the right feel that way. Now, let me be clear that I'm separating those who've moved from the right, tens of millions of people moved to the right, from those who are the hardcore of the right, because there in the hardcore of the right, there is racism, sexism, and homophobia, and there are a group of elite people who are looking to benefit the rich at the expense of the poor. But a lot of other people have moved in that direction for a different set of reasons, and they could be won to a progressive vision if it's a progressive spiritual vision. So the first thing that we do, what I do in the Left Hand of God book, and what I'm also doing in building this organization called the Network of Spiritual Progressives, which you can find on the web, by the way, at www.spiritualprogressives.org. What I'm doing here, and with my co-chairs, Cornel West, who is one of the co-chairs, and Sister Joan Chittister, a very powerful religious leader in the Catholic world, what we are doing is articulating a different and a spiritual vision that is a progressive spiritual vision. So the first thing that we're saying is, the first point of our network of spiritual progressives, and of course this is laid out in much more detail in the Left Hand of God book, is we need a new bottom line in America. We need institutions to be judged efficient or rational or productive, not only to the extent that they maximize money and power and hence generate the ethos of selfishness, but also to the extent that they maximize love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhance our capacities to respond to the other as a manifestation of the sacred, and enhance our capacities to respond to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation. So that's a whole different way of judging institutions, corporations, social practices, and if you take that way, you'll quickly see that almost every institution in our society is inefficient, irrational, unproductive. They don't tend to produce loving and caring human beings. Now, you might say back, okay, well, that's a nice idea, but how do you turn that into something political? And our answer is the Social Responsibility Amendment to the Constitution, which we are proposing in this network of spiritual progressives. And the Social Responsibility Responsibility Amendment says every corporation with an income of more than $50 million a year, okay, so we're talking about big corporations, every corporation with an income of more than $50 million a year must get a new corporate charter once every 10 years, and that will only be granted to corporations that can prove a satisfactory history of social responsibility to a jury of ordinary citizens. So we're not looking for some new government regulatory body, because we know that the regulators often end up in bed with those whom they're supposed to be regulating. We want to trust ordinary citizens to make this determination. So that's a first point of what this network of spiritual progressives is about, and I lay this out in much more detail because in the book, The Left Hand of God, I lay out a spiritual covenant with America that has 8 different points to it. We obviously can't go through them all here. But the second main thing that we're trying to do is to challenge the misuse of God by the religious right. Because so often what the Bible talks about a God of power, but when it does talk about a God of power, the right hand of God, it talks about that from the standpoint of God supporting the poor and the powerless to overthrow the powerful. But in the United States, in these contemporary right-wing churches, they've totally inverted that. And what they're doing now is they're giving to the powerful the blessing of God being on their side. In other words, the right wing of God that was the right hand of God that was in the Bible meant to be a force for reinforcing the powerless has now been appropriated by the powerful to justify their right to screw over the powerless. It's a total inversion of what the Bible is about. So we're talking, first of all, about challenging that, and, of course, secondly, strengthening the left hand of God, which is the hand of God that is the vision of the world that in which we can build safety and security through love and kindness and generosity. So that's the second point of our mission and what I talk about in this book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. But the third point, and very important for listeners, is that we are also challenging the religiophobia in the left. The antagonism and deep suspicion towards anybody who's progressive and spiritual, because we have managed, and this is one of the things I learned in this research that I did, we have managed to push away from the left a very large number of people who would support the politics of the left but feel demeaned when they come into the left, because there is a culture that essentially gives that the following message: if you believe in God or if you're a spiritual person, you are probably not on the same high level of intellectual or psychological development as the rest of us. There's something missing in you. So we might need your votes, so you're allowed to be with us. But basically, we think that you're somewhat retarded, either psychologically or intellectually, if you still believe in God or you believe in some kind of spiritual dimension to human reality. And we'll tolerate that, but we hope you grow out of it eventually. Well, this kind of a message, coupled with sort of visions of, well, these people are religious people are probably have a father problem. Maybe they need a strong authority figure. They're fleeing from freedom. They're scared. This kind of thing, which actually may be true for a section of the fundamentalist religious people, but is very condescending when it's applied to all religious people, pushes away a significant constituency who ought to be part of a liberal and progressive world. And so over and over again in interviewing these people, we heard these stories of people being treated as really second class and lower in psychological or intellectual development, and that more than anything pushed them away from the left and made them feel that, no, I don't want to be part of a Democratic Party. I don't want to be part of a liberal culture, because the liberal culture has nothing but disdain and dismisses me, and basically thinks that if I'm voting, that if I don't respond to them, I'm stupid or I'm racist or I'm sexist or I'm homophobic. And that people feel so misunderstood by the left that they often get attracted to a right that accepts them as valuable even when they don't agree with some of the content of the right's politics.
Again, I'm speaking with Rabbi Michael Lerner, the author of The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right. Obviously, Michael, it's so apparent the apocalyptic nature. I was just talking earlier with Robert Baer, the CIA officer whose his books have become the basis of the movie Syriana, mm-hmm. giving an extremely bleak picture of what's happening in the Middle East at the moment, since he knows that world speaks Arabic, etc. He was talking about the Iranian leader, Ahmadinejad, who I didn't realize is an apocalyptic Shiite, uh-huh. and he believes in the hidden imam disappeared from the very mosque that was blown up in Samarra, and he apparently sends notes down a well to this guy, and he's a true believer in this apocalyptic version of Islam, which is no different in a sense from the left behind Christian Zionist movement that is underpins the religious right in this country. And of course, they want our world to end in burning flesh so that their world can begin.
Right.
So there's a real sickness.
It's terrifying.
There's a sickness out there.
Yes, there is. And by the way, the left hand of God doesn't cure that sickness. What it's trying to do is to win to the liberal and progressive causes all those people who are spiritual or religious, but who don't believe in that kind of craziness, and who are open to something different, except they haven't heard that. And by the way, I just want to add here that our organization and this book is not just for religious people or people who believe in God. The Left Hand of God is not a book that addresses spiritual but not religious people as just as well. And our organization is at least a significant percentage of our organization, the network of spiritual progressives that we're building. We just had a conference in Berkeley with some 1,400 people, and now we're having May 17th to May 20th, we're having a national conference in Washington, D.C. to bring our spiritual covenant with America to the Congress. And what we're finding is that we attract a significant number of people who are spiritual but not religious. They don't believe in God. They don't believe in some higher authority. And they are totally welcome in our organization. So it's not just for people who are part of some traditional religious community. We are very welcoming to anyone who recognizes that there are a set of spiritual needs that have deep importance to people. Now, of course, some people say, fine, spiritual needs, let's deal. First, we'll settle people's material problems. Then, once we've done that, we'll address the spiritual problems. And to which I say, hey, I'm not stopping you. If you can build a democratic majority, and a majority that is willing to establish universal health care, that is willing to eliminate poverty globally, that is willing to renounce war, terrific, do it. We're not stopping you. The point that we're making is you're not doing it. You're not winning that way, and we have a strategy that will make it possible to win those material issues, like ending war and ending poverty, if you will accept a place for a spiritual discourse within the left.
And Rabbi Lerner, the other issue that's so central to new politics in this country are, I think, when you're talking earlier about family values and how the right have expropriated family values, and curiously, it's the poor, in this country that need family values, that appreciate them, the single mothers, et cetera, who are having a hard time, but they are carrying a family, so keeping it together. It seems to me that we have to redefine family values and the family. The last census in this country recently indicated that 75% of Americans do not live in the traditional Aussie and Harriet.
Yes,
but this atavistic vision that Falwell and Robinson keep pushing of the perfect family is an insult to all of those people who need to be honored, who are trying to do the best they can and to hold a family together. Obviously, the nuclear family is the perfect model, but it just doesn't work out that way. So
what
are we doing about redefining the family and honoring people who are trying to do the best they can?
Yes, and in my book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right, one of the eight planks of the spiritual covenant with America is being pro-families, not just family, but all the different kinds of families, including gay and lesbian families, including single-parent families, all the different mixtures of family forms we are supporting. But the way to support it is not just, it's partly, of course, to provide adequate health care, adequate child care, a full employment, and so forth, and we say all of that. But it's also to challenge the selfishness and materialism in the society and to call for that new bottom line that I was talking about earlier. Because if you have institutions that keep on reinforcing selfishness, people who spend all day in the world of work learning to look out for number one and not care about anybody else are very poor candidates for building loving relationships. In other words, we need to, using the banner of making this society safe for love, we can build a transformative politics in the society and a transformative economics in the society. Not because of the demands of fairness, but which has gone as far as they can go, not because we've won that, but because fairness has attracted as many people as it's going to attract. But a lot of other people who would be attracted to our agenda if we were saying not just fairness, but love. If we started to use the language of love and caring and kindness and generosity as the center of the central banner of what a progressive movement is about, we would be far more successful and win over people crossing the old left-right boundaries and bringing a lot of people to a very important progressive vision.
Thank you so much for joining us, Rabbi Lerner. And I guess just in closing, we can add to this that given the portent of global warming and the disastrous nature of what it can do to our planet, I think we also have to love our planet as well as love
each
other.
Absolutely, and that's another one of the eight planks of this thing, to love our planet and to defend it from all those who are raping it and destroying the future of the human race.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Rabbi Michael Lerner.
Many blessings, and as I said, www.spiritualprogressives.org, or go get the book.
Thank
Wonderful.
You. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the engineer, Jazz Shepherd, and the associate producer, Rusty Wynn. This program is on ianmasters.org.